These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled, Books That Have Made History, Books That Can Change Your Life, Part 2. Lecture 13, Plato, Phaedo.
I want to welcome you to our 13th lecture in our course on Books That Have Made History, Books That Can Change Your Life, in which we will discuss the dialogue Phaedo by Plato. In our earlier lectures, we have explored a series of books, not from the perspective of analyzing them in enormous detail, not from the perspective of applying literary theory and current trends to them, not with an attempt to impose any particular ideology upon them, but rather in the hopes that we can encourage you to read these books, reread them, and around quite specific themes that are raised by these books, and seeing if we can apply these themes, these ideas, this inspiration from these books to our own lives. And thus we have begun with the questions that I believe every thoughtful individual must consider, either again by conscious choice or simply by neglect. Is there a God? Is God responsible for what happens to you? Is there an order to your life, or is it simply random chance? And what is good and what is evil? Are there absolute standards of good and evil? And are there consequences for your choice to do good or evil acts? Or is, again, good and evil simply a question of circumstances, or indeed words without any meaning whatsoever today? Our next two lectures on the Phaedo of Plato and the Divine Comedy by Dante are a bridge that take us to the next main themes that we will consider, which is applying these lessons to your own life. How then should we live once we have come to conclusions about God and fate and good and evil? Both of these books are truly great works of the most enduring importance, and both written by noble men, by good men, men who were just and true. Both of them summarize a civilization at its apex, the civilization of classical Athens and its democracy for Plato, and the civilization of the Catholic Middle Ages for Dante. And both were written by men who suffered terrible wrongs. Dante died in exile under a death penalty from his country, from a democratic country, from his city of Florence, under charges of malfeasance in office, of corruption in office, and then a death penalty for not coming and standing trial. So he died accused of, convicted of corruption, and separated from his wife in a long exile. And Socrates, well, Socrates, who is the subject of Plato's Phaedo, Socrates dies at the hands of his own country. Socrates, immortalized by Plato, is in fact convicted of corruption and treason and sentenced to death. In our famous Greeks course, we talked about Socrates. He is the figure I most admire in history. He is the greatest teacher in history. And in famous Greeks, we saw how his trial in the year 399 BC was a product of the great war between Athens and Sparta. And we put it within its historical context. In A History of Freedom, we also looked at the apology of Socrates, the speech he gave before the Athenian jury in 399 BC, on the grounds that he had been wrongly accused of corrupting the young and not believing in the gods of Athens, but in new and different divinities. And we saw how he did not try to excuse himself, but instead spoke forth boldly the truth. And we saw his apology as a profound statement of the idea of freedom of conscience. We look now at the portrait of Socrates and the dialogue Phaedo by Plato for understanding on the question of not just good and evil, not just fate, but the question of, is the soul immortal? For if we are to believe in good and evil and take them seriously, then we must believe that there are consequences for good actions and consequences for evil actions. Otherwise, it really doesn't matter what you do. And Socrates, in the Phaedo, presents one of the most profound statements of the conviction that the soul is immortal. And in that belief, you have the guidance for your entire life. Socrates, the great teacher, never wrote a book. Just like Jesus, he never wrote a book, never would have gotten tenure in a modern university, never carried out research and publication. But his student, Plato, left a series of dialogues in which Plato pays the highest tribute to his teacher, Socrates, by putting all of his ideas into the mouth of Socrates, as if to say, without Socrates, I, Plato, would never have existed. And Plato? Why, it has been rightly said of Plato that all of philosophy after Plato is but a series of footnotes on him. He is the fountainhead of our philosophy. And Socrates was his intellectual father. Socrates was a true philosopher. I want to repeat, there is no connection between Socrates and professors of philosophy in universities today, teaching an arid discipline, cut off from real life. Socrates was a true searcher after the truth. He was a lover of wisdom, philosophia, the love of wisdom. And he spent his life searching for the truth, searching for wisdom. He went all around Athens questioning people, trying to find out what is justice, what is piety, what is God, what is good government. And it was this very questioning that brought him into so much disrepute with his fellow citizens of the Athenian democracy, and led ultimately to his trial, and as he said, their desire simply to get rid of him because he was troublesome. He made them think about these great issues. Thus, in the dialogue, the Phaedo, we find Socrates on his last day on earth. He is in prison, and he knows that on this day he is going to be forced to drink the hemlock, the poison. That was the Athenian method of carrying out an execution. And he is there with friends such as Phaedo, for whom the dialogue is named, a foreigner, like many, Simmias and Cebes, who have come from the city of Thebes. Phaedo is also a non-Athenian, but he has been attracted to Socrates, attracted by this charismatic man, an older man now in his 70s, not attractive physically, pot-bellied, bald, but attracted by the mind of Socrates, and has become his student. And these students are there with Socrates on this final day of his life, and they have come early and waited around until the jailer has told Socrates the instructions by which he will die. And they come in, and Socrates' wife is there, Xanthippe, with their three sons, and Socrates says, would somebody please take her home? She is just crying and weeping and just making a little scene here. Take her home, please. Now, friends, we can spend some time together. And his wife begins weeping again. Socrates, I will never see you talking to your friends again, talking with you. Please, just take her home. Socrates, you must tell us something. Yes, friends. Why have you suddenly started writing poetry? We understand that in the last few days you have been writing poetry in which you take the ancient fables of Aesop and turn them into verse, and also that you have written a hymn to Apollo. We never knew you to write anything for publication before. And he said, well, I'm not going to publish these either, but you know I had dreams. You remember, we go back to some of our discussions. The ancients took dreams seriously. I had dreams, and the muses came to me, the divinities of poetry, they came to me and they said, Socrates, make music, make poetry. Well, I've had this dream before, and I always thought that making poetry was in fact the search for wisdom, that my search for truth, my going around and questioning, That was my way of making poetry, but I thought, well, I better leave no stone unturned. And so I wrote some poetry. I wrote this hymn to Apollo, and I wrote these fables of Aesop. And I realized that I wasn't meant to be a poet. That, in fact, my search for truth is what I should have been doing all along. So I have been fulfilling my mission. Well, that's something I hope we can all say on our death day, that I have done just what I was meant to do. And my purpose in life, Socrates said, was to search for truth. You've got to tell us one more thing, Socrates, says his good friend Crito. Why are you so happy? You got to think of your situation. You're about to die. You're going to leave your children without a father. You know, this is not modern America where your wife can go out and get a job. What is she going to do? How is she going to take care of the children? You've never made any money out of this career of pursuing the truth. And what is more, look at your reputation. You're being put to death for corruption and for blasphemy and for being a traitor to your nation. Those are pretty serious charges. Surely you should be depressed. Wouldn't you be depressed? Think of your reputation. Think of dying. Why are you so happy? Well, why am I happy? Because my whole life has been lived for just this moment, to die. I have spent my whole life wanting to die, preparing to die. And indeed, anyone who spends his life in the search for truth, in the search for wisdom, is doing nothing but preparing to die. For death is the great liberation. Death is the moment when our soul is liberated from all the trials of the body. And when, if we have prepared for death, if we have lived our life in search of the truth, then our soul will go to the bliss of union with God. So why would I not be happy today? But Socrates, if dying is so great, why didn't you just kill yourself a long time ago? You were puzzling your friends. Well, no, suicide is not an option. You must think of it as we Athenians think of these matters. That is to say, you are the slave of God. Everything that you have, God has given you. You have slaves, Phaedo. If one of your slaves killed himself, that would make you angry. So God would be angry if you just killed yourself. No, you must wait for the moment when God wants you to die and be prepared for that moment. But Socrates, how can you say that the body is this prison which keeps your soul enmeshed? Well, think of this. What constantly distracts you from pursuing the truth, from pursuing wisdom, Sophia? What constantly keeps you from doing that? It is the cares and concerns of the body. You're hungry and you eat. Doesn't that distract you? You get tired and want to sleep. That takes away time that you could be pursuing the truth. You fall in love and you get married. And out of love, you create children. And what a drain on you those are. Look at those three I've got there plus this wife. What a constant harassment they have been. So all of these earthly desires of your body, they keep you from pursuing the truth. So the more you can do to get rid of desires, the more you can cut yourself off, keep away from communion with all of these bodily concerns, then the purer you will make your soul. Socrates, you see, one of the things that concerns us, though, and we know you have taught us this again and again, but in these last hours, we would like to be absolutely certain. How do you know your soul will continue after you die? How do you know that the soul is immortal? And how do you know that there are consequences for the good and bad actions you do? How do you know that all your life spent in pursuit of wisdom had any meaning? Maybe it was just a foolish task. Well, I am glad that you have asked me about that, and I only wish that comic poet, Aristophanes, who so many years ago wrote that savage play about me produced in Athens, in which he made me seem like a sophist, like a professor, concerned with the most tiny matters, concerned with science and how the earth turns around, and made me laughed at by the Athenian people, but also created in their minds the suspicion that I corrupted the young, that I tried to make the young able to produce a good argument and to say that what was right was wrong and what was wrong was right. And he so prejudiced the Athenians against me that years later they brought me to trial and sentenced me to death. I wish that comic poet Aristophanes were here to see that in our last hours we are talking about the absolutely most important thing for everyone to consider, your soul. But he's not here, you are, so let's talk about why the soul is immortal. You must understand that the immortality of the soul is the basis of everything that we have learned about together. What is the basis of our belief? That there are absolutes, that there is absolute truth, there is absolute justice, there is absolute good, there's absolute beauty. And that this absolute beauty exists in heaven. And it exists and is true even if everyone on earth denies it. Absolute justice exists even if everyone on earth denies it. And absolute justice, you see, gives us our standard by which we judge all actions. Absolute beauty gives us our standard by which we judge all works of art, all works of nature. Absolute truth gives us our standard by which we judge all statements, all beliefs. Now put that in our own terms. You find a nickel on the street, and you get a nickel and change at the Burger King. Now, each one of those nickels that has been in circulation is going to be a little bit different, aren't they? None of them will have worn the same way. And yet, both have the abstract notion in your mind, of equality. Both are equal to 5 cents. That is how there can be a multitude of actions on earth, but in our mind, we have the ideal of absolute justice. There can be a lot of statements on earth, and we can say, oh, well, let's hear the other side. But there is, in fact, a standard of absolute truth. And we are, Socrates said, born with that concept, with those absolutes. They are impressed upon our mind when we are born. Now, as we grow up, the world and the cares of the body, our desire for ambition, to flatter people, to get ahead, all of these corrupt these notions until by the time we're adults, we don't know right from wrong. But we are born with that knowledge. Do you not agree? People frequently talk about the Socratic method as though it's a lot of interchange of ideas. There's some of that, but a lot of it is Socrates giving you a lecture like that and then at the end saying, right or wrong? And you say, right. So right or wrong, are we born with these? Right. Well, where did we get them? Unless the soul existed before it came into our body. Are you following me? And there in heaven, where these ideals exist, it was imprinted upon the mind. So we are born with this knowledge. And our belief in absolute right and wrong, in absolute beauty, that is the foundation of our conviction that the soul existed before we were born, and that the soul will not pass away. When we die, the soul is immortal. But now, Socrates, see, that's another question. Even if the soul existed before we were born, how do you know it's not going to die when you die? Socrates, remember, one of the most interesting statements you have ever made to us is when you compare the soul to the harmony that is music. Yes, I remember that. Well, you know, you have a lyre, a music instrument, and it makes a wonderful harmony. And as you say, the harmony is like the soul because you hear it, you see how you hear how beautiful it is, but you don't see it. And that's like the soul. Well, if you take that lyre and smash it, then there's no more harmony. So how do you know that when you smash your body and are dead, the soul does not disappear? You know, that was a good comparison I made, but I've changed my mind. You've changed your mind, sure. I don't mind contradicting myself. Yeah, that doesn't work anymore. No. In other words, the soul is immortal because what gives you life? The soul. Look at you there. Look at those bright eyes, that nice smile. Look at that profound, inquiring look. Nobody has that look but you. And that is the soul speaking out of your eyes. And if I walk over and strangle you right now, that light is gone. You're just an empty body. So the soul is what gives you life. And absolute life must be the exact opposite of something else. What would that exact opposite be? Absolute death, correct? And no absolute can admit its absolute opposite into it. Absolute heat cannot admit absolute cold into it. Let's say we have fire. If we put snow on that fire, it's no longer going to be hot. So the soul must continue. It must be imperishable. We believe you, Socrates, but I don't know if you've persuaded us. And you know, that comes down to our central point. After all these years of searching for truth, spending my life in the pursuit of truth, not a career the way a professor or a lawyer has, but a life given to the search for truth, I have come to understand that the belief in this ultimate truth is just that, a belief. You cannot prove that the soul is immortal. You cannot prove that there are consequences for good or bad actions. You must believe it. You must make a leap of faith to believe it. But if you do, why? Kalon garto athlon, kai elpis megale. Fair is the prize and great is the hope. And it is in that hope that I can go so happily to my death. They're quiet for a while and thinking, and then one says, you know, Socrates, the jailer over here is a little upset. He says, you talk so much, you get all excited like that, it makes the poison slow to work. You just tell him to shut up. He's a nice fellow, but I'll talk as much as I want to, and if he wants to fix three times as much, that's fine. But at any rate, you got any more questions? Would you tell us then what you believe the afterlife is like? What is it going to be like? That's a wonderful question, and I have pondered it often. And you know, this is what I think. Once again, when I was a young man, I went to various professors, like Anaxagoras, men who charged high prices for their learning, and like going to Harvard or to Yale, and I thought they were going to teach me something, but they didn't teach me anything, and I wanted to learn about science, and I came to understand that science, what the sun is made of and things like that, doesn't amount to anything. Why care about what is on Mars when you don't even know what is in your own soul? Start with your soul and then worry about what is on Mars. But I have pondered what the afterlife would be like, and once again, you can't prove it. But I believe that the world is much bigger than we think. We live around the Mediterranean Sea, and we think that's everything, but I believe the world is much, much bigger than that, and far more variegated than we imagine. In fact, I'm not even sure we live on the top of the earth. We may live somewhere in the middle, deep under. The same way if creatures live at the bottom of the sea, they think that's the top of the sea. And they look upward and all they see is cloudy, the same way we look up and see clouds. And the earth, why, it's a multitude of colors and beauties. But under it are deep rivers. Rivers that some of our poets have described, like the river Styx. And they flow into a deep pit. A deep, fiery, terrible pit. I believe that when each one of us dies, our daimon, our conscience. Remember, Socrates was convicted by the Athenians of blasphemy on the grounds that he believed in new and different divinities. All he believed in was that every one of us has an individual God inside us, our conscience, or our good spirit, our daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, our daimon. And our conscience then accompanies us down into the underworld. That conscience that all through our life has been saying, wait a minute, That's wrong. That person is being persecuted and unwisely treated and unjustly treated. Stand up and say something, but you didn't say anything. You just let it go on. Or it is wrong for you to steal from that orphan that has been given into your guardianship, Mr. Attorney, even if you can make it legal. Well, that conscience, that God, takes you by the hand. And if you have lived a life in pursuit of truth, in other words, if you have purified your soul, then your soul goes down with your conscience, hand in hand. And if you have lived an evil life, then that conscience may have to drag you down there because you know what's waiting for you. Come on now. No, 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 no. I don't want to go yet. Come along. And your soul is heavy. It is burdened down by all the lust and avarice that you've had all these years. Or just your gluttony. Or your drunkenness. And your soul is heavy and struggling. But either way, either lightly dancing along, knowing what is in store for you is good, or being dragged along because you know what is in store for you is bad, you're going to be taken down to the underworld. And when you reach there, you will be judged by God. And your soul will be judged. And those who have done terrible evil deeds, why, they are thrown into the deep pit to burn. And those who have, in a moment of anger, done a bad deed. You got mad at me just for a moment and killed me. Or you got mad and robbed me. Or you felt desperate and robbed me. Why, those are thrown into a great lake. And they flow around and around. And those that they have wronged, the victims of their rash actions, stand along the bank. And the evil soul cries out, "I didn't mean it, let me out." And they float around crying like that until finally the victim relents. And those who have not done any evil action, but they really haven't purified their soul either, why, they just flit around for quite a while and then are reborn into other creatures. Maybe if you've had a tendency to gluttony, you might be reborn as a pig. And if you have a tendency to avarice, you might be reborn as a wolf. So they are reborn. But those souls who have spent their life purifying themselves in the pursuit of wisdom, why, they are freed forever and go up into heaven, and there are joined with God to know only happiness and bliss and purity. So that's what I think happens in the afterlife, and why I believe that there are consequences for good actions and bad actions, that God cares about good and evil, and each one of us, not some fate, each one of us makes our choices, and we will pay for it. That is why I'm so glad that you are with me in these last moments, and that I could tell you about this belief to which I have given my life. The time has come. And the jailer makes his presence known, and Socrates turns and again, absolutely happy, says, "That jailer has been the nicest of people to me, and I want you to give him a good tip when I go." And then the poison is prepared for him, and he drinks it. Turns to the jailer and says, "Now, I kind of forgot the instructions you gave me. What do I do?" And his friends are beside themselves. "Would you please not weep? Don't you realize? Have you missed the whole point of the lesson? This is a wonderful thing that is happening." "What do I do, Mr. Jailer?" "Well, you walk around until your legs begin to feel heavy." And Socrates walks around and around, and his legs begin to get heavy. Then he lies down on the couch, pulls the cover over his head and lies there still for a long time. Then drops it back down and speaks over. "Crito, my friend, you know what I did? I forgot to pay a vow to the god Asclepius. I owe him a rooster. Go out and offer one up in sacrifice for me. Because after all, Asclepius is a god of healing and health. and he is now healing me of all my earthly cares and all the desires of the body. So with his last breath, Socrates indicts that Athenian democracy that put him to death for not believing in the gods of Athens. No, he believed in them far more profoundly than those who accused him. And thus he died. And as Phaedo would say, that was the end of that man who of all the men of our day was the best, the most just, the finest man who ever lived.